We've been absent for nearly a month, and it's time to play catch-up. We're going to take a top-down look at two Formula One Grand Prix and four, well, give or take one, Verizon IndyCar Series race. Will we be able to stay awake and cover it all? This is Open Paddock. You hear our musical professor, Patterson. I'm assuming if you're in such a jovial mood, you have a fine beverage.
I do. I have I don't know, fine. I have a martini, okay. Which is quite nice, made with New Amsterdam gin that Kevin would have just given me no end of shit about it. And of course that's why I continue to buy it.
There you go.
Anyway, so it's not the greatest gin, but it's not bad. It's not bad. It's hard to pass up price for just a stock beverage. Kind of a go-to type of thing.
Cheap always has its benefits, so.
Well, as long as it's not McCormick's. Mm. You know, I'm not looking to start fires or dissolve adhesives.
Strip paint.
Yeah. Well, you know, McCormick's actually started out as a solvent company, and they got into the liquor business as a tax dodge.
Sure. That's working out.
It's working out great for them.
Yeah.
You know how much cheap hooch they sell?
That's true. How about you, Tom? You're over there. Do you have anything exciting to drink this morning?
No, because we can't afford anything. So I've got water.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, that got dark really quick, didn't it? So I'm gonna give props to my wife for this. She cracked open the commemorative bottle of fuzzies that we got in Indianapolis, and she soaked some chunks of watermelon in it. And they have been soaking in the freezer all night, and they're ice cold and still hard enough that I have to use a spoon, but they're starting to melt. And I have this, like, pink, pale pink liquid at the bottom amidst ice cubes
of watermelon. So watermelons are the new cherries.
Sure. Wow. And that actually is quite good. Quite potent, yeah. But quite good. So... Anyway, tonight, it's been a while. It's been nearly a month, so we've got a lot to cover. Let's not dilly-dally, as they say. Let's talk about Le Mans. It falls into that same month where we've been kind of sitting and absorbing all of this. And the big storyline had to be Toyota failing with, a little over three minutes left? You know, leading the race, looking like they're going to win, and just mechanical failure, and they were done.
You know, that's the thing with endurance sports car racing. Well, endurance racing in general, the Indianapolis 500 is like this too. It's more sprintish than it used to be. Well, 230 miles an hour, it's hard not to be. But of course, in a lot of these long endurance races, you often hear of simple $5 part, the bearing on it was Parnelli Jones's turbine machine.
Yep.
Back in 67, 68, I forget which year it was. I think it was 67. You know, a cheap part goes, and boom, there you are. You're on the side of the road, and this is exactly what happened to Toyota. It was. No part is inconsequential. I don't want to say that. But an inexpensive part caused the electrical failure of the machine. No drive, race over, one lap from victory.
Yeah. Very, very difficult ending to the race for Toyota. And sadly not its first difficult potential winning victory taken from its clutches.
No, but nor are they the first to suffer such a
oh no, not at all.
Such a heartbreak. It really stinks. Well, okay, I say this as a Porsche fan, right? And I was happy my boys won. However, it does stink given how well that car was doing, especially in the later stints.
Yeah, I agree. And they had been, the Toyota had been strong all race long. And their whole mantra going into the race was even, minimizing mistakes. Which, okay, if you think about Toyota, their road cars are known for what? Reliability, right? And that's kind of...
brake failures? Oh.
Hey.
Throttle issues, that's what it was. Did I say that out loud? I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's Takata airbags. The brand is generally known, for reliable and long living automobiles and that sort of thing. And they were trying to take that same ideal as they have been to Le Mans and apply it there. And it's sad because it looked like they had finally achieved it, with all of the money that had and the resources that they had put into that program. But like you said, it was just a tiny little part. I think it actually ended up being literally $5 or something like that for kind of connector. But the other big story was the reliving or the refueling of the Ford versus Ferrari battle from 50 years ago, and going into
that
it,
was epic.
It was. Well, it was great to see the performance of the new Ford GTs. But even going into the race, they got hit with not so much a penalty, but they adjusted the balance of performance, and they had to carry some extra ballast. I believe, as did the Ferraris and a number of other teams.
Let's call it what it was. It was a penalty for succeeding. The organization had laid out the rules. They developed a car that was within those guidelines and did a better job than everybody else, and they got penalized for it. Pure and simple.
Yeah.
Welcome to the modern racing. Yeah. Don't do too good or we'll smack you down for it.
It is a class that is reliant on performance balancing between the manufacturers. And you could argue that Ford did a much better job at lobbying for a better balance of performance as well within the rules and their cars. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's not illegal. That's perfectly fine.
It's available to everybody. Everybody had the same opportunity.
Yes.
Well,
yes, I can't argue with that.
And given the way the things shook out in the GT class anyway, even with the additional ballast that they had to carry, they pretty much dominated, not the Ford specifically, but it was the Ford and the new Ferrari 488 pretty much all race long.
Yeah, Corvette was nowhere. Porsche was nowhere. It was definitely Ford and Ferrari.
The Corvettes had some uncharacteristic problems too. So
I think that's the problem, though, isn't it? It was just the Ford and Ferrari. Look, if Corvette, Aston Martin, Porsche had got a better BOP, had been there, had been at the front, we wouldn't be having this discussion. The fact it felt and looked like it was entirely orchestrated by the organisers for Ford versus Ferrari battle is the only reason we're talking about Bob today.
Well, you've got a very valid point. and this goes to the other major problem that I feel exists in motorsport today. And it's not just sports car racing. It's NASCAR. It's Formula One. It's IndyCar. In that the organizers are putting more emphasis on the show than the sport.
Yes.
Agreed, 100%.
It makes for good headlines, but for those of us who've been watching racing, who are fans of racing, well, I wouldn't even just say fans, but enthusiasts about motorsport. It leaves a poor taste in our mouth when we see this happen.
Well, it does, and it only makes for good headlines if they can follow them through for the whole event, not back down after qualifying, which is what happened here.
Yes. Yeah, there's another big problem, changing the rules in the middle of the game. Of course, IndyCar has been doing this off and on. They did it, last year, and we damn near had another 2005 U.S. Grand Prix with half the field saying, nope, not going to do it. When they changed the rules post-qualifying, or amidst qualifying, I should say.
Yeah. While I'm certain that there wasn't any kind of collusion to try to artificially create that Ford versus Ferrari drama, it was certainly there on the racetrack. And Right. Not only on the racetrack, even at the end of the race, where... What was the ridiculous penalty that was handed down on the Ferrari so late?
Oh, their leader lights.
That's right. That's what it was. it's not like they could chalk anything up to, you know, battle damage after running, 23 hours and 40-some minutes at that point, you know? And there was... They never served the penalty, and they got hit with an infraction post race. I believe it was a time penalty. Was it not?
Yeah.
It was. Yeah. I'll let Doug say what he's going to say, then I'll say something.
Well, here's my problem with this. We're sitting here thinking, well, how stupid is that penalty, right? But fundamentally, it's how stupid is the rule, because the penalty followed the letter of the rule. And I've said this many times in the past, there is no spirit of the law, there is only the letter. You must obey the letter, and they did. And so my beef with this isn't that it isn't with the penalty itself, it's with the rule that forced the penalty to be called, if that makes sense.
No,
I don't. Three lights on the side of the car shouldn't affect the outcome of the race.
Something so silly like that. I mean, come on, it is an endurance event. The leader lights are nice for those of us who are watching, but they are not something that affects the performance of either the driver nor the machine, right? You make sure that thing is working, and pre-race, and away you go.
It's hard to imagine that anybody who the rules makers, that are talking about these things, that they can't foresee the need to have a provision for equipment not working after X percentage in a race, in a hard race, Le Mans used to be, there used to be an element of having to kind of save the car, save equipment for a certain part of the race. But that doesn't exist anymore. It's a 24-hour...
It still kind of does. You still have to take care of your equipment.
You do, but the equipment has evolved to a level where... the teams can run the car harder for longer periods of time. The drivers treat each stint more like a sprint race in that regard because the equipment is so much better. And under those conditions, you would expect that there's going to be equipment. Some things that are going to fail or that they're going to break, especially things that are on the exterior of the car. Like the leader lights,
Right. Now, with regards to the leader lights, I think the rule of having them be functional is fine if what you mandate is if they become non-functional during the race, then at your next pit stop, you must correct the problem. If you don't pit, then okay, there you are then.
Sure. I mean, but there's got to be a provision, at least in the rule set, to accommodate those, you know, those sorts of circumstances.
Right. Yeah, you don't say, hey, it's you're battling for the lead. We're going to hit you with this ticky-tacky little thing.
Agreed. But then the only reason why there was a penalty is because Ford mentioned it to the officials, and then Ferrari mentioned something back to Ford, back to the officials about Ford, which is why basically the penalties cancelled one another out. So,
well, I mean, and that's what they need to do, right? If you're not doing that, then you're not doing your job as a competitor. You know, even at the grassroots level.
Agreed.
You know, we have a period of time when we, as competitors in a national competition, either solo or rallycross, we get to inspect our competitors' cars. And if we see something that is not right, it is our right and responsibility to bring that to the attention of the stewards. And so I don't blame Ford for saying, no. Hey, that's out of compliance according to the rules.
But it does ask the question of, we're talking about the ACO giving a penalty for leader lights.
Yes.
And if the other people hadn't said anything, would they have actually done so? Probably not, is the answer.
I don't know.
I get both teams are playing the game. I accept that. Right. But it is a bit, I don't know. Prefer that. It just kind of, for things like that, I mean, Ford were going to win anyway. They were going to get a 1-2. I know they wanted a 1-2-3, which is why
right.
They mentioned a Ferrari. And then Ferrari obviously was annoyed, upset.
Well, of course, they were.
With a different penalty. But, yeah, I don't know. It's kind of frustrating that the race had to come down to basically arguments between the two after it.
Well, I'm just glad that that everything shook out reasonably quickly.
True. And on the lead light thing.
Well, yeah.
And not only did they shake out reasonably quickly, but they also shook out pretty much in line with the way things were on track as well. So all the effort that the teams put in, you know, and the drivers on track wasn't really for naught, you know?
Right. It's not like 91 or 81 when we didn't know really who won the Indianapolis 500 until October.
Yeah.
When all the fights finally settled down.
It's not like Silverstone's WEC race this year where we didn't know who won until a week later.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's pretty rough.
Same organizers. Just one more thing on the lead lights before we move on. They never work. They haven't worked for years, hardly. It's about the most unreliable thing on those cars, to be honest. They should really consider adopting what IMSA has, which is a much better way for the casual fan to follow anyway, and what IndyCar has, and what every other GT3 series in the world has, but Le Mans doesn't have, for some reason, yet.
Now, the ALMS, they used to use the same, you know, three-light system. Was that something that they adopted from the ACO in Le Mans, or vice versa, or do you know?
I think it started in America because there wasn't a world championship at the time, but the ACO adopted it for its LMS series, and then once World Championship was back, continued it. I think actually the company that developed it went bankrupt about a decade ago.
Hmm. Okay. You know, that's kind of funny, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me. So quick rundown on finish, you know, the podiums for each class in LMP1. Porsche was atop the podium, actually the number 2 Porsche, and behind them the number 6 Toyota and the number 8 Audi. And P2, which I'm not a big fan of the class, but I mean there's some good people. I mean there's some good drivers actually in P2s that, you know, kind of get overlooked. But the number 36 Alpina one P2. So, and then the number 26 G drive. And then
SMP Racing was third, yeah.
SMP. I'm trying to go off of a single PDF, and it's not very organized.
Which was Vitaly Petrov, the former Formula One driver.
That's right.
Yes. There was Will Stevens in there as well.
Where was I didn't see where Will Stevens. Oh, he was in the...
second year in the C-Drive car. I think that was Will's. Yeah, it will have been. And René Rast, who has quite a history with Audi.
So let's see, the GTE Pro, again, it was Ford and Ferrari, Ford and Ferrari, Ford and Ferrari. But it actually shook out with a Ferrari in the top and the bottom step with a Ferrari in the middle. Which, you know, it's actually kind of nice seeing that. And it was a great battle, intense battle, right until the end of the race.
It was a fantastic battle, and you know, I missed the night section because of while I was in the air at the time. I was on the way to a conference, but was able to watch live timing and the internets there at the very very end. And it was enjoyable to follow, even through you know, the less visual tools that I had available to me.
Well, with timing and scoring, and you know, if you follow Twitter or something like that, it's pretty easy to get you know, pretty comprehensive pictures of what's going on.
Yes, try following Le Mans through teletext. It's not so easy.
I can imagine. I can imagine. Anyway, rounding out the classes is the GT AM category, and the number 62 Scuderia Corsa. One of the pilots was Townsend Bell, fresh off of his run at Indianapolis, helping his teammate to win said race. So. They actually interviewed him on TV, and he made mention of that, you know, helping Alex Rossi at Indianapolis. I'm sure somewhat in jest, because winning class at the 24 Hours of Le Mans is huge. So, but behind them, another Ferrari and one of the Porsche 911s, but not one of the factory Porsches. Had problems very early on.
Yes, we should also probably mention that on the GTE Pro podium was Sebastian Bourdais, Scott Dixon, and Ryan Briscoe. Not in the same cars, but on the podium.
That's a good point. Yeah, I completely overlooked that. Thank you. And you are absolutely correct. With Sebastian Bourdais getting a win at Le Mans, at his hometown.
Yeah, that was really nice to see. And he was completely stoked to be able to do that, too.
Yes, he's tried for many years at Le Mans as Bordeaux, so it's good to see him finally get some victory there. Because he always seemed to have bad luck, even when he was with Porsche's LMP1 team. It never quite came together.
Yeah. Definitely big shout-out. He's got to be riding a wave of confidence off of that.
And you know, it's important to point out to some of the naysayers that you know the Verizon IndyCar Series has some serious neck level talent in it right now, and I think you saw that demonstrated at Le Mans. You can argue about the management and the race officials and the equipment and all that. But I don't think you can disparage the drivers at all.
No. Completely
no.
Agree.
Yep.
So, coming up in sporty cars this weekend, it is actually Monday the 27th, recording. So, coming up this weekend is the IMSA WeatherTech 6 Hours of the Glen. I'm sorry, the IMSA WeatherTech Sports Cars Championship. 6 Hours of the Glen.
That's about right, yeah, I think so. Yes, looking forward to that. Very much looking forward to that, actually.
Well, anything racing at the Glen is exciting.
Even NASCAR Glen is fun.
True.
Yeah.
And it's NASCAR road course, which has a comical entertainment value to it. So.
Right. Right.
Sports
cars.
That's
how a debate early said.
Sports cars are certainly not comical, or at least not intentionally comical. Somebody else put this in the show notes that Mazda is going to be running a throwback livery to 91.
Yeah, their Le Mans winning livery.
Oh,
the green and orange, the rotary livery. Because actually, I think it's mostly for Toyota's face in it, but it's about an anniversary.
Nice. That'll look pretty. I only hope that they're able to stay running. They've not had good luck past several years. Lots of reliability problems. So anyway, moving on into more fragile vehicles and more fragile egos. That's right. It's Formula One. I think Mr. Weitzel had the right idea of just kind of pushing Formula One off in the corner, and yeah, it's kind of there. But okay, the two Grand Prix since we last recorded one of these, we had the Canadian Grand Prix, and we had the European Grand Prix, which is in Azerbaijan, which is not in Europe.
Half of it is.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think where they were was just, right?
It depends which way they want to politically lean that day.
Fair enough. But, okay.
Extreme Eastern Europe.
Yes. Okay, well, that's a...
Were they west of the Urals?
Technically.
Okay, then it's in Europe.
Anyway.
From a geographist standpoint, that's Europe. Now, politically, that's a whole other matter. But
financially, Bernie Ecclestone doesn't care as long as the check clears, right?
Correct.
So, real briefly, the big issue in Canada was with Nico and Lewis, and their... I don't know how would you describe that entanglement?
Entanglement is probably the best way to describe it. Turn one, general chaos, I think, would be another way.
Yeah, I mean, but when you're the dominant team with the championship leader, you don't expect that sort of chaos, so. But it was unfortunate. It ended up with Nico being kind of pushed way back, and he ended up for him was an uncharacteristic fifth, and allowed Lewis Hamilton with a win to gain in points. So going into Europe, I guess
Canada wasn't a bad race in general, though.
No,
it wasn't. A classic Canadian Grand Prix by any stretch, but it wasn't bad.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was more entertaining than the following week, the much ballyhooed European Grand Prix. So, okay. I think it was expected that Baku was going to be a parade based on the nature of the circuit, but I don't think anybody expected it to be as bad as it was.
No. I did... The circuit itself, though, I didn't mind it. I quite like the narrowness of the... It's kind of weird. We have this... This is why fans should probably not decide what Formula 1 should ever do, because this is why we have DRS. We moan like hell about having massive runoff areas everywhere. And then we get a track that has no runoff areas, so nobody overtakes. And then everything goes wrong. and then we have a very dull race and we complain that it was dull and we want tracks with massive runoff areas again.
Fair point. The only thing about Baku, though, is because the circuit was so narrow, the only thing it had going for it was that ridiculously long straight, and all the passes were DRS enabled. I have to think, though. Okay, going into the race, Lewis Hamilton, was it in Q2 where he, on his final lap, he nipped the wall and in that little tight section and broke his suspension and was out? It was either the end of Q2 or the beginning of Q3 where he did that. And I think that maybe some...
I think it was the end of Q3 because I'm pretty sure he started 10th.
Yeah, okay. So he... all the other drivers were looking. If Lewis Hamilton, because he is... one of, if not the best driver on the grid today, you could argue. If he can miss by that little, that little tiny bit, and trash his car, I think that put in the minds of everybody else on the grid to employ a little bit of caution, a little bit more caution than maybe they otherwise might. So.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yes, agree with that.
So anyway.
Well, there were some sections of the Baku circuit that were just stupid tight. The Castle section, especially. Right in a bicycle through that.
I think that little chicane, I think, was that 6 and 7 or 7 and 8, was the narrowest point was 7 feet.
Yeah.
Agree. When you think that, you think of places like Macau... and poor, and you think that they're really, really tight tracks, and obviously nothing bigger than F3 races there for a very good reason. And then you think that they let this place be Grade 1 FIA circuit?
Yeah.
It's kind of laughable.
Well, they did pave over the cobblestones.
Yes, thanks for that.
Yeah.
It would have been entertaining, at least.
I think so, too, but I don't know whoever was involved in the process. They said, yeah, the cobblestones got to go. We can't have that.
Yeah, they tried saying that at Indianapolis. Bernie walked across the yard of bricks and says, no, this is going to have to go. And Tony George said, my ass.
Yeah, that ain't going to work. But, yeah, I don't understand how they could get like you said, Tom, the Grade 1 certification. Or there must be a different certification for a street circuit as opposed to a permanent road course, though.
Right, I don't know, because if you look at the regulations, the only thing that Grade 1, I think, needs to say is the type of cars that race on it. I don't think it's actually anything to do with the track, other than that we seem to think it is, because obviously... every Formula One circuit is to a certain standard, except that one, and Monaco. But I'm pretty sure that the only thing that actually the FIA regulations say is that it's got to be Grade 1 if the cars, it's a certain acceleration that they have, and it's basically Formula One and LMP1s on the edge. Preferable.
Well then, see... from that standard, I don't see how someplace like Road America or Watkins Glen isn't Grade 1.
Agreed. I assume there's some financial deal in getting certification for Grade 1 as well.
Oh, I'm sure there is.
Which is presumably why they don't. Which is presumably why they don't, because it's not worth
it. Well, they don't need to, right?
No, the only, like I said, the only thing that actually explicitly needs it is Formula One.
Right. I would love to see Formula One back at Le Mans, or not Le Mans, sorry, at Watkins Glen. Oh, it would be, wouldn't it? But no, I would love to see an East and West U.S. Grand Prix again. Circuit of the Americas is a fabulous track, but I'd love to see an Eastern U.S. Grand Prix at Watkins Glen. I think that would be great.
I think it would be, too. Unfortunately, if the rumors are true, it's probably going to be on the Strip in Las Vegas.
Yeah, ask Cart how well that worked out for them.
Hey, that was... They
Formula One's been looking... Formula One's been looking at Vegas since I was born.
Yeah, yeah.
The story that I heard, apparently there's a financial backer that has, like, money in place. If the city, and they're just waiting for the city to say okay, to let them do it. So, again, I read it on the internet.
Well, it's got to be true.
It's got to be true.
Bonjour.
So let me ask you this real quick, not to delay us too much, but what is in it for Las Vegas?
I don't know. Promotion, I think. You know, more global promotion.
Does Vegas really need the promotion? And I guess here's my thing.
Good point.
You know, Vegas is huge. They make mad amounts of money. They make mad amounts of money because of the Strip. If you invite Formula One, you're shutting it down for, what, an entire week, right?
Essentially.
And especially during the money-making part, the weekend. And so, yeah, okay, you're going to draw potentially 100,000 people there. Are 100,000 people then going to go drop coin in the dollar slots or on the blackjack tables or the craps tables in the Bellagio or anywhere else on the Strip? Yeah. I don't know that they're going to make that much more money off of a Formula One race than they would during a normal weekend. Compared to how much it's going to cost to bring Formula One to town and the expense of shutting down the Strip and surrounding areas to support a Grand Prix.
Agreed.
It's kind of like the Olympics.
Yeah, I agree. But there is a history of casino towns in Formula One.
Oh, there is.
There's Monaco, which, okay, it's not a town. It's obviously a country, but it is basically a town. Macau.
It's basically a casino with an economy built around it.
Yes, yes. Macau, which, again, is an economy built around a small city. And I suppose we did race in a car park in Vegas once, but let's not mention that.
Yes, yes, let's not.
Yeah, I don't see any upside for the city, like you said, Doug. I think it would produce lots of really pretty photographs. And, of course, Formula One with the, you know, big money and the glitz and the glamour and all of that. I mean, that is right up Las Vegas's alley. So it fits well in Las Vegas for that reason. But let's be honest, if they do a race incorporating the Strip, part of it's going to be on the Strip. The rest of it's going to be in a parking lot.
Right.
So, yeah.
Hey, you set up some cones. Formula One autocross.
Okay. Think about the track in Baku. That's pretty much what you're going to have in Vegas. You know, it's going to have this long straightaway down the Strip, and then it's going to do some funky turns or something around one casino, and then back up the Strip, and then do some funky turns around another casino.
Right.
So,
agreed.
Yeah. So, not really. So, anyway, you know, looking at the two Grand Prix, the Canadian and European, really you had an opportunity for Lewis Hamilton to make hay on his competitor, and then in the European Grand Prix, that all went to hell, so we're back to exactly where we were beforehand, points-wise.
Anyway. The circle of life.
Yes. The circle of Mercedes, in this case, I guess, with that little tri-bar, three-spoked thing. Anyway. So, IndyCar. The rest of the open wheel world, or at least the North American open wheel world. Since we chatted last, we've had four races, or at least four attempts at it. The duels in Detroit were, well, they actually went off as planned. And Sebastian Bourdais, before his win at Le Mans, got a win in Detroit. How does that work?
You know, the Detroit races, the way they've reconfigured that track, it's been very good. They've widened enough places to allow some overtaking to happen. And I think we saw a couple of pretty darn good, exciting races. My big complaint about Detroit is that damn place is bumpier than my gravel road.
Yep.
It reminds me of the parking lot of a football stadium in Houston where they tried to run away.
Yes, I think that was smoother.
That was definitely smoother.
Well, except for turn 10.
So,
maybe Baltimore over the tram tracks.
Oh, jeez.
Before yeah, or after
when
that.
IndyCar did a 30-foot jump.
Yeah, paint all the cars orange with a Confederate battle flag on the hood or on the top.
Yeah. Oh, we can't do that anymore.
No, that would be on PC.
Right.
But to really quickly go through, because you know we are we still have a lot to cover. Race one, playing some strategy, we had a podium with Sebastian Bourdais. Our good friend Connor Daly, and Juan Pablo Montoya. So that was really exciting to see. And watching him hold off, well, you know, look who was behind him, Montoya, Rahal, Casper Neves. That was a hard-fought podium. It wasn't just, you know, strategy, get up there and hold everybody off. So, but the second race in Detroit, it was... Then it was all Penske. Where was Penske in race one? Did anybody see them?
Didn't qualify in Ghost Landy to bits for them.
True.
And the race, I think that was it, if I remember right. And that's why they were further down the back of the grid than what anyone expected them to be. Montoya kind of represented them in the first race.
Yeah, he was able to come back up and finish. But you had, you know, Pagenaud down in 13th, Power down in 20th, but he had a mechanical issue.
I'm pretty sure Pagenaud had an issue too, but I can't think what it was.
Yeah, so, yeah, unfortunately, Detroit are the two that I don't pay too close to, because they usually are dull, and this was, you know, they happen to be more exciting than usual.
Here's the other problem with Detroit. I know that, you know, people want to strike while the iron's hot, and, you know, they want to be that next race right after the 500. But the 500 is so huge, and, you know, I know it's not the month of May anymore. It's the 2.5 weeks of May.
Ish.
It's still a... you know, it's still a pretty epic event and a long event, right? Especially given the cycle of motorsports now, where it's, you know, people are pushing towards two-day events. You know, even getting away from the three-day Friday practice, Saturday qualifying, Sunday race type of thing. You know, after coming off of Indianapolis, man, everybody's hung over. Some figuratively, some literally, but you know, you need a little decompression. I would love to see that week right after Indianapolis be a blacked out weekend, and I'd like to see him take a little break, take a breather, and use that extra week to, you know, promote. Hey, we had this fantastic event in Indianapolis. Why don't you come out and make travel arrangements to come to our next race at Detroit, at Texas, wherever it happens to be? I would like to see a little bit of separation. You know, Detroit just happens so fast after the 500.
No, I agree, and I think even the teams have to.
Especially the teams,
because they put so much emphasis on the 500 that. You know, coming off of that, once you're done with that, you've got to kind of pick up the pieces of not just physically, and I don't mean just car parts, but you have to readjust to the rest of the racing season after, you know, so much emphasis on this just on this one big race. So, yeah, I would agree. I think a week separation between whatever is next. Robin Miller likes the idea of Milwaukee possibly, or I don't know.
I know Eddie Gossage.
That's a surprise.
Yeah. Well, okay. I don't think Detroit is necessarily even bad for being the race immediately after the Indianapolis 500. And yes, they want their duels format. Well, Roger Penske wants his duels format.
Bingo.
Which, okay, it is.
He's a bad, I suppose.
Yeah, pretty much. Which it is what it is. But yeah, I agree. Giving the teams, the drivers, and even the fans, you know, like you said, a week off to pause, take a deep breath, recharge, and then get back at it. So, but yeah, like I said, the Detroit races were better than expected or better than typical. But the second race, it was what we expected, which was all Penske. With it ended up being Will Power gets, was this his first win of the season? I believe so.
I think so.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I want to go back and give a huge shout out though to Connor Daly, who got his first podium.
Oh, yes.
With race number one, right?
That is correct. Second place.
That was a mad drive. That was a mad drive, and great strategy call as well.
Oh, phenomenal strategy call. And he had to help hold off everybody behind him. That was you know, I mean, he had everybody from Montoya on back.
So right.
That was impressive.
And you know, here's the thing, and you've heard this rant before if you've been listening, but. You know, there are some people who say, well, you know, he just lucked into it because of strategy. I'm like, I'm sorry, no. Strategy put him, it gave him the opportunity, but luck is the convergence of opportunity and preparation, right? He had the opportunity because of the strategy, but he had the skill to make it work. And as you say, he had to hold off some serious talent like Montoya. And so, well done, that man.
Definitely, definitely. Much praise. We need to see if he'll talk to us poor schlubs again.
Yes.
So I'll have to reach out to his media contact. So anyway, day two, all Penske all the time. Any surprise?
No.
No.
I think the only surprise is really that Pagano was not on the top step of the podium for race two. Granted, he finished as well as he could without winning, but, you know, as far as points goes, that's certainly positive. But you were going to say, Tom?
I was just going to say, I guess it's kind of the balance sifting again at Penske. Power obviously has a general very good on street courses, and Pagano's kind of come in and replaced that again, and now it's swinging back the other way, and that's kind of cool. Power's kind of reasserting his dominance at Penske on road courses, I guess, or trying to.
Yeah, he's trying to. He's shown that not only in Detroit, but you know, we can even look ahead into Inter-Road America as well. So,
yep.
I would like to see that shape into a bigger points battle, but I think we'll get into Road America and see how that shakes out in the points. So we may have that, but we will, we'll talk about that before we get there. We can round out Detroit race two, which, like I said, Power, Pagano, and then Ryan Hunter-Reay with, kind of a surprising Honda being up there with amidst them, I guess somewhat, but Andretti themselves have not been looking terribly strong. This is the one time where they've shown any kind of pace.
Yeah, agreed. Dritty has really struggled in general, except for Indy. It's been a pretty rotten season.
Yeah, agreed. Definitely. So after two races in Detroit, I believe they had a week off and went to Texas. Is that correct? Do I have the calendar correct?
Yes.
So,
Yeah, there was only a week between the Detroit and the original Texas race.
the original Texas race. I mean, they never got to run any significant session. I don't think there was a full session where they were able to run a couple of practice sessions that were interrupted either by rain or the track not being dry or dry enough. And they tried all day Saturday to race and never, I mean, they never got on track on Saturday, I don't believe. The track got dry with the exception of, I believe, there were some portions in turn one or turn four that they were having a problem with. And they never could get it, you never could get it dry enough to race. And then it rained again.
No.
And then they had to dry it again. I mean, it was like a losing battle.
Pretty much. I know they drew a few complaints for people kind of sitting with no information for a long time, but I don't know. I guess that's what happens when you go out to a race and it rains on an oval. Never experienced that, but
Well,
just how it is.
I think that IndyCar, they made the best of the circumstances. Even on the broadcast, they were talking. They were recounting Alex Rossi's win at Indianapolis, as well as they were talking to other drivers. And a bunch of the drivers actually just kind of spur of the moment. They just went up into the stands. And they had, cell phones, and they were doing, Periscope and, that sort of thing from up in the stands with a bunch of fans and signing autographs and, that sort of thing. And figure these are fans who had been sitting there waiting all day just in the hope of seeing a race. And when they find out, well, at that point, they didn't even know that it wasn't going to happen. It was just the driver saying, I think the drivers did it more to keep themselves amused as well as providing fan goodwill.
Agreed. IndyCar might not have a very big fan base, but it does have a very loyal fan of what's left in terms of when you go to a track to see a race. They do tend to stick around if rain affects it or something, which other series tend to have them disappear quite quickly.
And this is why. Again, you can rail against the management and all the other aspects around IndyCar, and I would agree with some of the arguments, but the drivers in IndyCar are some of the best in motorsport. Not
Agreed.
just not just and I don't mean that just from the talent standpoint, but they understand on what side of the bread the butter is, right? They understand what drives their sport, and it is fans. It is fundamentally the fans that drive any motorsport, because without the fans, why are the sponsors involved? Right? And so, taking it upon themselves spontaneously, say, hey, let's go and engage with our people. That's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. And, it made for, made for a great time for the people there in the stands who have been during delay upon delay upon delay. It made great headlines. It made for great PR. It was fantastic all around.
It was even great, but to those of us watching on TV, seeing, hey, look, this is what they're doing. This is pretty awesome. So, yeah, I'm all.
I've always said that the of all the various top tier racing series around the world, IndyCar is probably the most fan accessible of any
Right,
of them.
definitely.
And Tom, we need to get you over here for a race sometime.
Money. Hopefully sometime.
Need to we do like what Tony Green is doing. You know, his boy Alex Green is an aspiring young racer in karting right now, and he's got a GoFundMe site to try and raise money to get some competitive equipment so young Alex can really stick it to some of the other drivers and teams. We need to get a GoFundMe account. You know, get Tom to an IndyCar race type of thing.
I don't think it'll have many much support.
Well, yeah, maybe not. Yeah, the exchange rate right now is really killing you. It's great for me trying to buy rally tires, but it kind of sucks for you trying to get over here.
Yes. hopefully one day in the next 4 years it might work out. We'll try. We'll keep trying.
Okay, sorry for the derailment.
No worries.
So they actually didn't get this race in all the way. They finally did get it started, though. They had to terminate on the Saturday night, and they raced, what, on Sunday, was it?
Yeah, they raced on Sunday for
a time. John, I think you had the lap count. What was it, 71 laps they ran?
I think it was 71.
Before they eventually had to call it again because of rain. You know, Texas has just been hammered by rain, which is, first of all, is a little weird because you live in Texas, right?
Yes, I do.
John? Yeah, you have just been hammered again and again and again with epic levels of rain. You know, and just biblical styles of. Have you been building a boat yet?
Yes, I've got the plans for one, but then it stops raining, and then I don't think about it anymore because it looks like I'm not going to need it. So,
you haven't had any voices in your head. How long can you tread water?
No, fortunately. So.
Okay.
I'll have to ask Kelly though, so just to be on the safe side.
That's a very, very meta reference right there.
Oh, I'm. Trust me, I get the reference.
Oh, I know you did. Ding. I know you did. But anyway, so yeah, you know, this time of year, you know, getting the epic amounts of rain that you have over the spring is really unusual, beyond unusual, and
freakish.
So freakish, and they've had this. They had the problem at Texas. That you see in other places, you know, it's not an unheard of problem, although it is extremely rare at a place like Texas, where you get lots and lots of rain and the track dries out, but then, you know, hydrologic pressure being what it is, the water pushes back up through the cracks in the tarmac. And if you've ever been to Texas Motor Speedway, and I've had the privilege of being there for three races I think I've been there for. And I've loved every single one. And I want to find a way to get back there again. Because I love watching races at Texas. But it is in a bit of a bowl.
Yep.
Right? And
it kind of is a bowl.
And so it is a bowl, right? And so a lot of the track is below grade.
Yep.
And that means that, you know, when you have lots of rain, the water table is right there underneath the tarmac, and the pressure pushes that water back up through the cracks, and you get what are called weepers, right? You dry the track out, but the water comes pushing back up through the cracks, and I think it was turn three where the biggest problems were.
I don't remember, but they had a number of them.
Right. And they tried making some cuts to try to relieve some pressure, suck out the water. And again, we've seen this tried at other tracks. But it just wasn't happening. And they tried to get some laps in. And we'll talk about the incident here in a second. But eventually the rains came again on Sunday and washed it out. And yes, they could have done it. They could have tried it again on Monday, they would have been facing sort of the same situation. I think they would have been struggling just to get to the halfway mark and then say, yep, it's good. But I think they did make a good decision to say, you know, let's bail on this and reschedule for a drier time of year, albeit an even hotter time of year. As August. Texas isn't hot enough.
The only hope is, okay, the rescheduled date is August 27th. The hope is that you're kind of coming off of the, you know, that super hot wave of weather, and maybe starting in, you know, in the downhill toward fall, but right. We'll see. It's
you
still
know,
August
I
in
will
Texas.
Say, though, that, you know, there in Houston, you guys are, well, like us here in Kansas City, you're stupid humid all the time.
Yep.
Right? For different reasons. Well, sort of different reasons. Your humidity comes off the Gulf, and so does ours. but although Dallas isn't as dry as, say, out in the Southwest. I just came from New Mexico, there in Santa Fe.
I remember.
And, you know, it was, you know, low 90s, mid-90s, but it was comfortable. It was weird. You know, it's a dry heat, but, you know, it does make a difference. It's not quite that dry, but it's drier than it is most places in the Midwest. And drier than I think it is there in Houston.
By a long shot.
And so while the afternoons are brutal, you know, they really are brutal. But when you run this race in the evening, when the sun goes down, you don't have the sun beating down on you, all of a sudden, it's a pleasant place to be. And so, you know, I know there are some people complaining August is going to be, you know, it's going to be hotter than Satan's, insert, you know, rude comment here. but, you know, it's, I don't think it's going to be as bad as a lot of the naysayers are trying to make it out. I think this is this is one of the few wise decisions, I think, that IndyCar is making. And of course, this is fully backed by Eddie Gossage.
Of course, you know, he's got an opportunity to get people coming in. I don't think they've announced
and sell more tickets.
Well, yeah, true. But I don't think he's announced, at least I don't think the Speedway has announced as far as how they're handling tickets and exchanges and that sort of thing. But IndyCar did announce their plans for the rescheduled race. They're basically going to pick up on lap 72 where they left off. The two drivers that were involved in an incident that brought out the final caution before it was red flagged, which were Joseph Newgarden and Connor Daly, they were out of the race. They will still be out of the race when it is rescheduled in August per the rule book, which is unfortunate, but it is what it is.
Well, it's appropriate.
Sure.
It's appropriate. Since it's a continuation of the race, yes, it would be unfair to let them continue.
Sure. And
agreed.
And for those who didn't watch that little portion that they were able to run, it was, I mean, it was a simple matter of Connor Daly was underneath Joseph Newgarden, got loose and collected him and took them both out.
Very nasty accident. Glad both were okay.
Relative. It was a bad enough accident that Newgarden had to go to a local hospital. He didn't get airlifted out. He went by ground. And he had a broken clavicle and I think his wrist or his arm. Is that correct?
Pretty sure his wrist, yeah.
His wrist and his clavicle, his collarbone.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a pretty brutal injury. He had some serious hardware put into his shoulder to keep it together. And, you know, when you break your collarbone, they can't put you in a cast unless it's going to be an upper torso cast to hold that together.
Right.
Right. I mean, how are you going to hold that together? And so it's a brutal injury. And it's an injury that, if you don't respect it, it can easily become re-injured or, you know, cause you some permanent discomfort or disfiguration. Ask me how I know someday. cycling incident back when I actually was fit and half the man that I am now.
You know,
well, okay, 1.5. I'm, you know, never mind. but anyway, I've been back on the fitness wagon and trying to shed some pounds, get back down to some racing weight. But you know, it, having suffered the same type of injury, not, you know, of course, in a race car, but on you know, from cycling, it is tough to heal from. And if, like I said, if you don't treat it right, you can re-injure it, or it, you know, it won't heal right. And so, man, it's nasty. It's absolutely nasty.
Well, and we can't minimize the accident itself. I mean, we've kind of glossed over it, and I think that's kind of paying it disservice. It was a nasty crash to the point where Newgarden was sliding along the safer barrier in the trioval, kind of upside down at an angle with his head either, I don't know if his helmet was more against the safer barrier or on the pavement. Neither one of those is comfortable, I'm sure.
Thank God for roll bars.
Yeah, no kidding. There was actually a place, a point where the safer barrier, the box metal pieces, one of those was pierced by some part of Newgarden's car. And from the angle, it looked like, and there was speculation that there was part of the roll hoop, was what had caused, you know, what had pierced that section of the safer barrier. But it turned out that was not the case, fortunately. So, yeah, looked really ugly. But and when Newgarden got out of the car, he just kind of slumped there on the ground. It was a little bit scary watching.
Oh, it was. You know, he got out of the car and he's like, "I'm okay, I'm okay." He said, "I'm not okay." You could watch the adrenaline just drain from him.
Yeah, and it ended up in a puddle underneath him, and he ended up in a puddle underneath him too. So
there,
yeah,
it was, right there on the tarmac. Yeah, it was.
So, but fortunately, he ended up being okay after they rescheduled the race, and you know he had a week off again after the Texas race. Mm-hmm. Considering the nature of the injury. There's a lot of speculation he was going to miss Road America and how many other races after that. Iowa, maybe? Because that's, like you said...
Expect him to miss at least two.
I did as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was... And realistically, I mean, there would stand to... There would be a valid argument for him, you know, bowing out even for the rest of the season just to make certain that he's healed. But no... he was back in the car this past weekend in Wisconsin. And I think he got cleared to drive, what was it, like Tuesday or Wednesday before?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, he got cleared early.
It's hard to miss Road America, isn't it?
Well, it is, especially when you're doing as well in the championship as he is.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so. And
I mean, I don't think that he's going to be... in the hunt for the championship title,
but I think he's possible.
Yes, absolutely. I think he is capable of getting a top three, top five type of finish, and that's still huge. It's still absolutely huge for a small team like Ed Carpenter Racing.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. They've...
Very well known team, but still a small team.
Yeah, and even smaller after their the disintegration with the, you know, Sarah Fisher.
So. Oh, sure.
So, I mean, it was really good to see him in the car. But during the race from Road America over the weekend, they, you know, showing the X-rays, that made my shoulder hurt, you know. and they were talking about him as far as what he was getting as far as pain medications and, you know, whatever kind of shots he was getting for painkillers. Definitely, you know, a lot of credit goes out to him for pushing through that. That couldn't have been easy. But apparently Ryan Hunter Ray also was dealing with the flu at Road America. So I don't know who had it worse. You tell me.
I have to say that New Garden had it worse. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because New Garden, in addition to the shoulder pain that he had to deal with, he also had the hand injury.
True.
That he had to deal with. And where is most of that load? You know, you think about those high speed, high G load corners with no power steering, mind you. You know, where is all that load transmitted? It's right through your hands and wrists.
Yep.
Right? And right up through your shoulder. And that's not to minimize Ryan Hunter Ray's discomfort, because that sucks too. But the pain that New Garden had to be in. In fact, I think for the race, he actually gave in and said, yeah, give me drugs.
Yeah. You know, I thought it was, I don't know, I thought it kind of a disservice to New Garden, the way that they were going on about New Garden and how sick he was and he had to take IV fluids and all of that. Don't get me wrong.
Ryan Hunter Ray?
I'm sorry, yes, Ryan Hunter Ray. Don't get me wrong. He's sick, and yes, he probably needs to rehydrate.
And it was a brutal thing to have to,
sure,
to have to endure.
Sure, but
if you remember, at St. Pete, Will Power actually sat out St. Pete because of the same sort of condition that Ryan Hunter Ray was dealing with.
Sure, sure. I don't know. It just seemed kind of, I don't know. The amount of play that they gave to Ryan Hunter Ray's flu symptoms compared to, you know, the amount of play that they were giving to New Garden, who was coming back from that substantial injury, didn't seem fair really to New Garden, or kind of diminished the severity of injuries, at least the way it was presented on TV.
It wasn't commensurate with the severity of the injury.
At least until they showed you the X-ray. The X-ray kind of brought it home, but yeah, until then, you're right. So let's talk about Road America. IndyCar's return to Road America. I think everybody had a lot of very high expectations, especially longtime fans.
Of course they did.
And I think that IndyCar over-delivered. As far as the how good the racing was, unfortunately the great racing wasn't up in front. I mean, Will Power qualified on pole and he kind of trotted off to victory. But everywhere else, man, it was Katie bar the door. It was crazy in the best ways.
No, it was. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
Sorry, that kind of heading off into the distance at Road America, that's exactly what used to happen anyway. You go back to sort of 85, 86, and Mario Andretti basically just driving off and leaving everybody else to collect what's left of the points. And finishing sort of 30 seconds up the road from Danny Sullivan or whatever. It kind of is how it was. To actually have the close race that we got was more uncharacteristic of Road America than characteristic, really.
You know, the thing that I remember of the race, and yeah, Will Power did run off with the lead, and what typically happens in those situations is, I tell you, if this had happened on ABC, what would have happened is the cameras would have been fixated on Power, and that would have been it. You would say, oh, God, what a boring race that must have been. But NBC did a good job of showing, and the commentators did a good job of highlighting the battles that were happening throughout the grid. And, you know, this is something I've said repeatedly, season after season, race after race, is that, you don't always have to have five people up front battling for the lead, right? What What you want is some good battles highlighted in the race throughout the grid. If one guy is out just giving a clinic, great. You highlight them and say, hey, this guy is doing an amazing job. By the way, while he's doing that, here's all this other exciting stuff that's going on. And I think NBC did a great job of highlighting that.
Sure, I completely agree. And it was good to see a few drivers up there in the top 10, which aren't generally up there as well.
I'm so bummed that that Connor Daly's suspension broke there at the end, because I think he could have been, I don't know if he had podium material, but he would have been really, really close.
He was up there. He you know, Connor Daly benefited from the way qualifying shook out. He was able to make the fast 12. He put a banker lap in on reds as early in the session, and then the session was interrupted. I forget why, but yeah, that put him in basically P1 for his round of qualifying, and moved on to the fast 12. So he ended up qualifying, I believe, ninth or 10th. So yeah, he had great track position from the start and held it up there and was running.
Between sixth and fourth, pretty much for the whole race.
Yeah, and in fact,
until it broke.
Yeah, in fact, when the suspension broke, he was going into turn one against Ryan Hunter-Reay, and it's amazing that Ryan Hunter-Reay, you know, didn't get collected and all of that, because Connor Daly just kind of shot by him. It was pretty scary to see.
It was. It was pretty brutal.
So. But fortunately, he was okay, and it was just it was a control arm, was it not?
I think so, in the rear.
Yeah.
In the rear.
Yeah, so, completely broke it. You know, obviously, when you're going at 190-plus, and that breaks, you're not going to be able to stop, and he didn't, and he went through the gravel and into the tires, so. What a shame.
A nice result for Spencer Pigot in ninth. Good to see
him get. Yes, yeah, I was really happy to see that result. You know, I loved watching him come up through USF 2000 and in Pro Mazda, and seeing him in Indy Lights. He had a good career in Indy Lights. I'm really happy to see him get a chance in IndyCar, and I think he's doing really, really well.
Couldn't agree more. And, you know, Newgarden also, despite his injury, came back, you know, finished in the top 10, right ahead of Spencer Pigot. I mean, he's one of those people who's going to prove to be, you know, that kind of Iron Man kind of driver as time goes by. So...
You know, I just want to give a shout out to the Mazda Road to Indy that Dan Anderson has put together. This is a phenomenal ladder program, and when you look down through the results of the Kohler Grand Prix there at Road America, you see lots of names that have come up through this Mazda Road to Indy program, including Charlie Kimball in sixth, who had a great race. He had a phenomenal race. And he was in P6. And then Newgarden in P8, former Indy Lights champion. Spencer Pigot, that we were just talking about, P9. He ran in, I loved watching him in USF 2000, Pro Mazda, Indy Lights. And then you have Carlos Munoz, who was in Indy Lights with Andretti Autosport, now a longtime member of Andretti Autosport and IndyCar. Jack Hawksworth, Pro Mazda and Indy Lights. Marco Andretti, who ran in Indy Lights. James Hinchcliffe, of course, ran with Team More Racing back in the day in Indy Lights, as well as Sam Schmidt. And Gabby Chavez, Connor Daly. You look through, and what you see is that this ladder program is effective. It is effective at developing racecraft in these young drivers, getting them in front of the people they need to be in front of to advance their career and actually find rides in the IndyCar series. A lot of type level series could learn some lessons about how this ladder program is been created and is managed and deployed. You know, Formula One has Formula One has some issues right now with their ladder program, and that it is not clear. And in fact, it's become even murkier now with the row between Bernie and the FIA with regards to the potential Formula 2 and GP2. There's no clear progression from GP3 to GP2 and all the other junior formula series that there are in Europe. It's something where if you want to develop young talent for your series, this is how you do it.
It is. There is a slight question of supply and demand, which is why Formula One has so many junior series. But I do like the American model, and I do like the Virtu Indy model, and it is what the FIA is trying to do, but
right.
There's too much competition to do it in Europe.
Well, you know, I think that, yeah, you have an abundance of junior formula series between the various F4, F3 spec series, the Formula Renault and Formula BMW and all those. But as you get closer to the top, it really needs to be funneled down. You already have a GP2, GP3 program. They really need to develop that in a clear way for, hey, if you win the GP3 championship, here's a scholarship to go find a ride in GP2. And if you win GP2, you know, great, we'll give you, you know, some money or a guaranteed at least testing program. If not reserve driver program with Formula One team. There needs to be something like that in place.
But it sort of fell apart.
Yeah, and yeah, thanks to egos.
Pretty much.
But anyway, perhaps the Maserati Indy is successful because there is a singular driver behind it. Right,
mm-hmm.
And a driver that has the backing of the IndyCar management,
right?
In Dan Anderson, and maybe that's the big difference. And,
yes.
And it's not that we don't have, an abundance of Formula Car Series, Junior Formula here in the States, and we got the SCCA doing Formula 4, Formula Lights, as much as in Formula Lights is struggling. Their delayed season isn't going to start until August.
There's Skip Barber.
You got Skip Barber, but Skip Barber is fading. You've got the other SCCA Pro series, F1600, F2000, and Formula
Atlantic. Is there still
an
Atlantic series in here?
Yeah, there is still the Formula Atlantic series, but, as time goes by, those series, they provide places for some people to run, but they don't really go anywhere.
No.
If you're going to advance anywhere in, through the ranks, it pretty much has to be in the Maserati Indy or you're going to Europe.
Yep.
Yeah. And let's face it, for an American going over to Europe, that is number one, expensive, and number two, difficult.
Isn't it just? Yeah, and from a multiple variety of aspects, it's completely different type of racing. I've talked to a lot of young drivers who raced over in Europe and then came over here, it's completely different. You see some of that with some of the young drivers that come from Europe over to here, and you see them really struggle with. The difference is not only in the types of track, but in the style of racing that is here.
Mm-hmm.
So it is challenging.
Yet another reason why we need to see if we can get Connor Daly on the show again.
Exactly.
Perfect man to be able to make that comparison.
Well look at Alexander Rossi.
Yeah. Max Chilton as well. Certainly. He's not the only one. You know, we've already kind of gone down the leaderboard in the finishing order, but the one name we haven't seen is Scott Dixon. First of all, that yellow Clorox sponsored livery was just hideous to look at. And when he went out, when did he retire?
Lap six.
Yeah, very early on, and they were saying something about an engine fire, but it might have been that the engine wouldn't fire, or they need to fire the engine, or something like that.
No, I think there was a concern for fire because he had a fire marshal pulled over, but
right. Oh, they were. Yeah. So, yeah. But yeah, whatever it was terminal, unfortunately.
Turned out it was a header issue.
Oh, was that what it was?
Yeah.
What a shame, because I mean, it just, well, that just changes the points, doesn't it?
It does. And you know, it is uncharacteristic for Ganassi to have such a mechanical failure. But quickly on the livery, one thing I want to point out is that Ganassi has put together a really fantastic sponsorship program with Target, in that it's not just Target that's sponsoring those cars. It's Target and the collection of the various brands that that are sold through the Target stores. And so that's why you see some of these special liveries coming through. And okay, maybe the color scheme didn't look the greatest, right? But, you know, still it is they are doing exactly what you need to do to keep those cars on track and in top form. It's a well constructed sponsorship program.
No, I certainly agree. And from a marketing standpoint, it's genius on the part of Chip Ganassi. I still contend that it would have been a brilliant marketing opportunity if they showed up with the yellow livery on Saturday for qualifying and then removed all the yellow to white to really promote Clorox, you know, bleach the car. I think that would have been brilliant, but I didn't get that. So, oh well. But yeah, the header issue took him out on lap six, which ultimately changed up the points. And Pagenaud, after all of this drama and Dixon failing, Pagenaud still retains the points. But I think within 100 points of him, you have how many drivers? Six drivers? Five drivers.
Five drivers.
You know, and 100 points at this point is still, you know, well within
100 points. Nothing, yeah.
That's so
a bad race, pretty much. A couple of bad races.
Exactly. Or with the double points again at Sonoma.
Yes. Yes, of course.
So we've got Pagenaud, Castroneves, and Power, your three Penske front runners, and then Dixon, Newgarden, and Kanaan. Two Ganassi drivers and and Ed Carpenter Racing. So behind him, you know, Ray Hall, with as hard of a charge as he was making last year, is kind of far back. I wouldn't say he's completely out of it, but he's not where he was last year by any means.
No, they haven't had it quite as good as last year in terms of results. It's been good, but it's not been as strong.
Yeah. I will say he is still the the best performing Honda out there. You know, when we, you know, in the beginning of the season, the Hondas sucked. I mean, there's no mincing words about it here. They sucked. They did not choose well when it came to their aero package, right? They've been playing catch up for the you know, pretty much all season. They seem to have gained a lot of ground at Indianapolis. And since then, they've been, well, you know, the Chevys have have continued to show they've got it when it comes to the road and street courses. However, the primary contender trying to push the Chevys of Ganassi and Penske has been Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan, led by Graham Rahal. And so, is he scoring wins? No. But he's routinely on these road and street courses the best Honda out there.
Agreed.
You say that he's the best performing Honda. If you look at the points, Carlos Munoz, by virtue of his second place finish in Indianapolis, is a single point ahead of Graham Rahal. However, that points total is not necessarily indicative of his overall performance.
That's just it. I mean, look at the performance on the road and street courses. Okay.
Oh yeah.
And so that's what I mean here, is that when you look at the Honda performance on the road and street courses, it is being led easily by Graham Rahal.
Yeah, by leaps and bounds. Andretti has been, like I said earlier, pretty much an also-ran.
Yeah. Yeah, they have been, unfortunately.
So their GRC team is kicking ass, but,
GRC.
Hey, at least they're doing good somewhere. I'm trying to stay positive here, but yeah, it's there's still a lot of season left in a little bit of time.
And they got the biggest prize of all.
The biggest prize of all.
Oh, well, they won Indy. So yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. With Rossi.
Right. It was a partnership with Brian Herta Autosport and Andretti Autosport.
Right, but it was a very good move for May in general anyway for Andretti.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely it was.
So,
The one bit of controversy from, if there was any, from Road America was probably Rahal's pit exit.
Yes.
It's quite funny, isn't it, after like a year of complaining about blend lines and things like that in IndyCar, and then we go to a track that doesn't have one, and there we go.
Well, you know, Ray Hall wasn't the only one that had issues with pit exit. And some of it I blame on the geometry of the exit. I would like to see that exit, and they mentioned this on the broadcast, I'd like to see that exit curl around turn one and blend in after the exit of turn one, instead of dumping out right at the breaking point and entrance to turn one, right where you can cause the most amount of calamity.
Agreed.
And there were certainly a lot of almost calamity. But part of that is what was exciting. All of those pucker moments was somebody was coming barreling up the hill, as it were, or over the hill when somebody was coming out of the pits.
Munoz.
Munoz for one.
Chicken and jiving, trying to find a way through this massive crowd of people that were exiting.
I think TK had one of those too. Just crazy moments, and there was like two or three people coming out at the same time that he had to get around. So, but I agree. As exciting as it was, erring on the side of caution and changing the configuration to something safer. Yeah, but I would agree that that's in order. So, but yeah, that was a hell of a race, and all of the racing from Road America this weekend, from Pirelli World Challenge to all the Mazda Road to Indy ladders was just phenomenal.
Man, the Indy Lights races were absolutely astounding.
Agreed.
Great racing, and well done, Zach Veach. I really think he got kind of hosed at Indianapolis. He definitely had the fast car at Indianapolis. By far, he had the fast car. He was the only person
200.
To break into the 200s in an Indy Lights. He set the speed record in Indy Lights, joining Tom Sneva as the first person to break the 200-mile-an-hour barrier. Unfortunately, we got half the field. We had half the field qualified for Indy Lights before the skies just opened up. I mean, the drops that were coming down, they're like water balloons falling out of the sky. It was just torrential. And that ended it, right? They lost the track. That was it. And so they qualified via points, which was extremely tragic for Veach, because that put him back mid-pack and put him back near R.C. Enerson, who's a good driver, but he's still a little reckless. Still needs some work on the racecraft. And he and Veach got tangled, I think it was turn three, if I remember right. John, you might be able to help me out with that. Anyway.
In which race?
In the Freedom 100.
Oh, yes.
He was moving his way up through the field. I think he started seventh, and he was clawing his way up through the field until he and RC had contact, and that ended his race. It ended his race, and such a shame to see. It was. And so this was vindication for Veach. Got his first win with Ballardi Auto Racing, his new team. Second win in Indy Lights. And unfortunately, he had a spin in race two at Road America. But even despite that spin, he still made it back, clawed his way back for a podium finish, finishing P3 in race two on a wet track, a wet but drying track. It was great driving from Veach all week long, or all weekend long. It was fantastic to see. I'm really looking forward to seeing how he finishes out the season.
Definitely with a strong finish. That'll be exciting to watch. So anyway, we have almost accomplished our goal of trying to put this together in 90 minutes. We'll see what happens after I get everything edited out. So, any parting shots from either of you, Mr. Patterson or Mr. Firth?
None for me, Tom.
No, none for me. Just was really nice to have a good weekend at Road America, which was focused on the racing and not on the politics for once.
Amen. Couldn't agree more.
I beg your pardon. I do have a quick thing. I do encourage you to look into getting involved in SCCA Rallycross and getting even your daily driver out there and dodging some cones out in the field. It's hella fun. And at this year's national championship, I happen to know one of the course designers. And so come out to Indianola in, I believe this is the first weekend in October. Coming up here surprisingly soon. You think, well, October is way far away. Well, it's only a couple of months, right? A couple, 3 months. So not a whole lot of time. Get out there, get some seat time, get your car sorted, and come have a blast with us throwing mud and dodging cones up in Indianola.
Sounds like a good time. Couldn't have said it better myself. So with that, good night. We'll be right back. every time, Doug.
I do.